91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we begin with literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez and his interview with prolific investigative reporter Gerald Posner. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Posner's latest book is God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. It chronicles the financial history of the world's biggest and most powerful religious institution, the Roman Catholic Church. And more, Linda Gassenheimer gets out the word about this weekend's Grilling in the Grove barbecue festival. It gets underway Sunday at Peacock Park. Besides many barbecue styles, there'll be local craft beverages. So, up next, Gerald Posner on Topical Currents. First, this news.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. We begin today's program with literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez, who visits with popular investigative reporter Gerald Posner. In the tradition of Deep Throat's classic Follow the Money Guidance, Posner has written God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. He tells of the Roman Catholic Church's long and complicated relationship with money and the secretive Vatican Bank. Intended to fund religious projects, the modern Vatican Bank has allegedly financed numerous nefarious projects and events. Ariel Gonzalez first wanted to know if the church's financial irregularities were due to incompetence or corruption.
A combination of both. In fact, it's one of the worst managed companies, if I can call it a company for a moment, in terms of its finances that I've investigated or looked at. Mismanagement is just rife for decades. In addition, they've had endemic corruption during a period of decades, from political slush funds to the use as a money laundering center by the mob and wealthy Italians. So the efforts to reform it today have to concentrate both on making the people who run the finances better, real managers with transparency, as well as rooting out those reasons why the corruption has flourished, which is basically the darkness of the bank that it operates in secrecy.
Did Benedict XVI's resignation have anything to do with those financial irregularities?
The best I can do is speculate based upon a thousand rumors inside of Vatican City, which you can imagine. Everybody inside the Vatican has their own special reason as to why Benedict resigned, and only he knows, and he hasn't said. But we do know that three cardinals that he appointed to look into problems with the Vatican Bank came back to him with a 300-page report sealed as secret. It's still secret inside the Vatican, hasn't been released. And according to those who claim to know and the leaks that have come out, that report talked about major financial shortcomings inside the bank, as well as problems within what was referred to as a gay lobby inside the hierarchy of the church. Benedict received that report on the very day he later said he decided to resign. It could be coincidence, but the feeling is that he was overwhelmed by a host of problems, including the finances.
Well, that term, gay lobby, it stood out to me. What exactly is the gay lobby?
Right. I'm not the first to report on this. I'm taking the reporting from Italian journalists who have reported on this beforehand. And it is the idea that you may have priests who are heterosexual or gay, straight or gay, who don't act out on their feelings and they keep their celibacy vows. That you also have some priests who don't keep their celibacy vows. To the extent that those running Vatican City are having affairs with women, they're having them outside of Vatican City because there are no women or single living inside of Vatican City. It's 1,000 clerics living with each other. To the extent that gay clerics who are moving up the hierarchy of the Vatican have broken their celibacy vows, if to the extent there's a casting couch or the equivalent of it in Vatican City, it must by its very definition be gay because there are only men involved. They're living and working with each other. So it's not surprising that might be a small problem, but it was a problem evidently raised to Benedict and passed on to Francis.
We're speaking with Gerald Posner about his new book, God's Bankers. What impact has the sexual abuse scandal had on the finances of the Vatican?
Almost, I was going to say almost no impact at all. Very little. Well, yes, surprisingly. It is surprising because people think that when they hear about the bankruptcies of American dioceses, there have been 11. They hear about 20, 50, $100 million judgments. Boston diocese scurrying to sell property and closing schools because of the judgments against them for pedophile priests. They think, therefore, it must be hitting the Vatican. I have a chapter on the sexual abuse crisis, and the Vatican's response was very much a financial one, to make sure that it was insulated from the lawsuits taking place first in America and then in Ireland and then in Australia and New Zealand as they popped up around the world, that if a diocese went down someplace because it couldn't pay the victims the amount that a court eventually held against it, the Vatican wanted to make sure that the Pope and the Vatican Bank was not going to be held responsible. To their great fear, In the 90s, the Pope was sued by a number of American lawyers here claiming you're the chief, you're the CEO. These priests are your agents. They're doing the crimes. You're not reining them in and throwing them, you know, out of the priesthood fast enough. It went through a number of appeals courts, and finally an American appellate court at the highest level said the Pope is immune. He's a sovereign of a foreign country. You can't sue him in an American court. There was a big sigh of relief back in Rome. The reason I modified my original answer of almost no impact is the indirect impact, we can't quantify it, is that fewer donations go back to Rome from American Catholics. So if a diocese is going under and it's sinking, the bishop for that entire area is going to first appeal for donations to help to save that diocese or other churches that have to make the payments on these pedophile abuse cases. And there's very little extra to head back to the Pope. So there's been a drop in the American contributions.
Didn't a federal judge declare in 2012 that the priests were not employees of the Pope? How did he come to that conclusion?
You know, it's a fabulous part. I'm an attorney. I guess I'm the type of attorney that most people like the best. I'm a non-practicing attorney. But I look at these decisions and sometimes marvel at them. The Vatican's defense was energetic in that. They made essentially the equivalent of the argument that priests around the world, tens of thousands of priests, are like free agents. They're 1099 employees.
So it's basically like McDonald's franchises.
Exactly.
Because that's what they do with those corporations. When a franchise screws up and serves rat food, no, they're a franchise. It's not part of our...
It's not part of the corporate entity. The corporate entity here, the headquarters, the CEO certainly is the Pope and that little patch of land that is a sovereign entity back in the heart of Rome. And they've made a very, very good point of ensuring that the wayward activities of priests abroad, not just in the pedophile cases, but in cases back in the 90s when a group of Pauline monks outside of Philadelphia were running up $20 million in fraudulent activities. After World War II, when five priests in Sicily were made members of the mafia, were convicted of that, the Vatican's always made sure that they're able to say those priests are out there on their own doing terrible things and we don't approve of it. And don't come after us for a dollar of or a lira or
so,
now a
so
euro
compensation.
So they treat
their clergy as outsourcing.
For legal purposes, for the equivalent of outsourcing, yes.
Right. We're speaking with Joe Posner about his new book, God's Bankers. Let's talk about the Vatican Bank. Why does the Vatican have a bank?
That's a great question, and one that the Vatican sometimes has a tough time answering. Pope Francis, when he became Pope in 2013, said he was reviewing the issue of whether the Vatican needed its own bank, and the simple answer is it does not. Before 1942, before it had a bank, it formed it in June of 42, it had no bank and did all of its financial dealings through correspondent banks, through Chase Manhattan, through the equivalent of Citibank, the House of Morgan, and others. It could do that today, but in the middle of World War II, the financial wizard who was then handling the Vatican's finances thought that a bank would be better for a sovereign country. And we use the word bank, but it's an odd bank. I call it sometimes a mixture of the Federal Reserve and a mid-size investment bank on Wall Street. It doesn't give out any loans. It doesn't have any obligation to turn a profit. It has one shareholder, the Pope. So it's not a traditional bank in most sense of the words. It has no branches other than Vatican City. You can't walk into the Vatican Bank anywhere else. It takes physical deposits. Until 2011, there was no law in Vatican City or in the Vatican against money laundering. there was no limit on the amount of cash you could deposit into the Vatican Bank without having to report it. So in America, we're used to $10,000 in cash. It gets reported to the government. There, you could put in $1 million in gold or in cash and nobody would say anything. Now those laws are in place, but only in the last few years.
Well, let's talk about two individuals, financiers. Roberto Calvi and, I'm trying to get their names right, Michele Sindona. Yeah. They were very involved with the bank, and to its detriment. Tell us something about them.
I think Michele Sindona and Roberto Calvi are two iconic figures, and we overuse the word iconic, but in this case, I think they are in terms of Italian business in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Sindona was, by Time Magazine and the New York Times and others writing about him, one of the leading lawyers, financiers, putting together business deals, viewed as a sort of a legendary man when it came to revitalizing companies. He bought here in America, Franklin National, one of the biggest banks. And he was the Pope's personal banker from the 60s on. He became very closely involved with the Vatican Bank, with the American bishop who ran the Vatican Bank, a fellow called Paul Marcinkus from Cicero, Illinois.
This was Monsignor.
Not a cardinal. Right. And then later became a bishop. It was appointed by the Polish Pope, John Paul II. Calvi came just a little bit after. He was a friend of Sindona's and Marcinkus. He was a banker for a large bank in Italy called Ambrosiano. And the three of them did increasingly complex offshore deals. The bishop who ran the Vatican Bank became a director of a Bahamian offshore company started by Calvi. And they did hundreds of millions of dollars in back-to-back loans, which essentially are fake loans to bolster the profits and the balance sheets of different companies to make them look as though they're stronger than they are. Eventually, it all came tumbling down. It was like Ivan Boesky on steroids, but gone bad. So Sindona's empire collapsed, with Franklin National being the biggest ever bankruptcy at that point in history, $2 billion. He went to prison for bankruptcy fraud. He was convicted in Italy of murdering. The Italian prosecutor was investigating him. He died in jail a few days after being sentenced. What turned out to be cyanide poisoning, the Italians ruled it was suicide. Calvi met an even more unusual end in his demise. His body was discovered hanging, dangling from a London bridge right in the heart of London with a rope around his neck. And the British said it's suicide. And 25 years later, they said it was murder. The head of the bank, the bishop, with then Monsignor to Bishop, Marcinkus, was indicted by the Italians. The Pope refused to release him. He said, we're a sovereign country. You can't have him. It went up to the Italian Supreme Court. They sided with the Vatican. He never spent a day in jail, and he came back to America where he was in a retirement community here in Sun City, Arizona.
And he was never indicted in the United States.
Never indicted in the U.S., and it really tested the limits of the sovereignty of the Vatican. Was the Vatican able to keep people inside its own little two-thirds of a mile without handing them over to the Italians for crimes? And the answer is yes.
Well, we need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Gerald Posner. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're seeing Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're seeing Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is Gerald Posner, whose new book, God's Bankers, is a history of the complicated relationship that the Vatican, the Roman Catholic Church, has had with money. Gerald, you know, you probably saw Godfather Part 3.
I did, unfortunately.
Where the Vatican Bank is very much central to the plot. And there are fictionalized versions of the two financiers we were talking about last segment, Sindona and Calvi, and even Marcinkus, a fictionalized version of Marcinkus. But there's also a fictionalized version of John Paul I. Now, you sort of became famous, debunking conspiracy theories. You made your bones on bones. Your first book was debunking the idea that Joseph Mengele, the Nazi war criminal, was still alive when you found that he was dead. He was quite dead. And then later, probably still your most famous book is Case Closed, which was debunking all the conspiracy theories associated with the John F. Kennedy assassination. Well, there's another conspiracy theory here concerning an assassination, an alleged assassination, and that's Pope John Paul I. Now, nobody probably remembers John Paul I because they just think about John Paul II. So tell us about John Paul I.
You know, Ariel, it's very interesting because John Paul I was the Cardinal of Venice, and he gets elected in 1978 after the 15-year papacy of Pope Paul VI. And he's known as a reformer. So he comes in, and Marcinkus, the bishop who's running the Vatican Bank, has had some problems. A lot of people think he's going to clean that up. He's going to clean up problems with Cardinal Cody back in Chicago. 33 days later, he's dead. And there have been rumors from the get-go that he was killed because he was poisoned and he was a reformer. I would love to be here today and tell you that after debunking the Oswald and Kennedy case and Mengele, that I found that John Paul I was really murdered, because it'd be a hell of a story. But in the end, what I found out is the Vatican screwed it up. I'm not surprised. They didn't do an autopsy. They decided to change the story and lie about how he was found, because he was found by a nun, the same nun who put coffee in front of his door every morning at 5:30 and then came back to pick
it up. That's important. This is all about a woman.
Yes.
I mean, I knew that it had to do with sex, because or their paranoia with sex, the sexual paranoia, because it's just because a nun found him in bed, dead.
And having grown up as Catholic, having gone to 8 years of Sisters of Charity and 4 years of Jesuits, and with all the guilt that the Catholic faith can give you about sex, I understand that this must have horrified the cardinals who discovered that a nun was the one who opened the door and went in the early morning hours to discover the body, because people would think, as they would think, that there must have been something untoward happening. So they made her lie. They sent her away to a convent. They told other priests to say they had found him. When that cover-up unraveled, and the fact that they hadn't done the autopsy, and that this was a reformer pope who died unexpectedly, the rumors picked up steam, and then a good British writer did a book called In God's Name, David Yalop, in which he said it was a murder, and I think it sold 6 million copies, more than I'll sell in my entire life with another 20 books. So it took hold, and in the end, I find out there was no murder, but there was a lot of mismanagement and bad decision-making and everything else. And the next pope who came in didn't clean up the Vatican Bank, but took a liking to Marcinkus and ended up using Marcinkus and the Vatican Bank to help fund a war against his native Poland against communism, and became an ally with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. So the whole scene changed.
We're speaking with Joe Posner about his book, God's Bankers. Let's go back a bit. Let's touch on the Vatican's, I think, really dark side, which is its relationship with fascism. Now, in 1929, Mussolini signed the Lateran Pact with the Pope at that time. I think it was it Pius XI?
Pius XI, exactly.
Pius XI. And this established the Vatican City State. There was no Vatican City State before that. It was just the Vatican and, you know, it was a church.
Right. There hadn't been a Vatican Empire, secular empire, since 1870. So before 1870, the Vatican had its own empire, the Papal States, 15,000 square miles across central Italy. Popes were Pope Kings, so they had the same power as a monarch would in Spain or Germany or wherever else. Then they lost it in 1870 when the Italian nationalists unified the country. They were reduced to this little postage stamp size of land, 2/3 of a square mile wide, Vatican City, and the Pope stayed a prisoner inside the Vatican protesting the loss of the Papal States. It was Mussolini, as you just said, who gave him, Ariel, the greatest gift. He restored the sovereignty. He didn't give them any extra size. He said, you're still that small little size of Vatican City, but you're now a country. The Pope is restored as a sovereign as well as the head of then the world's largest church. And he paid them the equivalent of $1 billion in today's money as compensation for the loss of the Papal States, acknowledged them as the only religion inside of Italy, and the Pope acknowledged Mussolini and the fascists as the right government for the country.
And that money was used by Bernardino Nagara, the founder, really, the father of the Vatican Bank.
The founder of sort of modern Vatican finances. I mean, a guy who knew arbitrage and knew how to move assets around. And what you just said, Ariel, is key. They were smart enough. Pius XI was smart enough to know that he didn't know how to manage the money, and he knew none of the clerics could. So he brought in a fellow who really was a financial wizard, and Nagaro managed it expertly. He did in the war something that I'm not surprised at, but I think I found the information about how they invested in German companies in Eastern Europe through these Italian proxies in insurance companies.
Yeah, tell us about the insurance companies, because I found that to be very insidious.
Yeah,
especially how they profited from Jewish victims.
The insurance companies, the largest Italian insurance company was one called Generali, which was founded by Jewish Italians, had a Jewish board, and had more business in Eastern Europe with Jews because it had made that their goal from the turn of the century than anybody else. When the anti-Semitic laws were passed in Italy that mimic those in Germany, all of those Jewish directors were forced to resign. The person who took over Generali was the closest friend of Nagaro, you mentioned before, as running the Vatican finances. Nagaro invested in Generali, and then the Vatican took a majority interest in Italy's fourth largest insurer, Fondiaria, just a couple of weeks after the Jewish directors were purged off. All of those companies were operating in the killing fields of Eastern Europe, cheating life insurance policies from Jews who had been sent to Auschwitz. Allianz and the German insurers like Munich Re sat around a table and said, gee, these people are all dead anyway. Why don't we take the cash value of their policies now and boost our profits? After the war, they refused to pay out anything to families. They said, where's the death certificate, knowing there could never be one produced? Can I show you that the Pope knew about that? Is cheating of the life insurance policies? No. Can I show you that Nagaro knew it? No. But I can show you that the Vatican earned outsized profits from their shares in these insurance companies.
They may not have known about it. They were blind to it, because that's the whole thing. Everything about this organization is see no evil, hear no evil. That way, silence,
right.
you know from Man for All Seasons, from the legal concept of silence implies consent. And they are very silent. That's their reaction to every criticism, silence.
You know, it's very interesting. You're absolutely right. And as you say that, there's the entire question of Pius XII silenced during what I call public silence during the war about the Holocaust, at a time when the Vatican had better information about the killing in Eastern Europe than anybody else. I mean, the Allies have nothing to be proud of when it comes to speaking out against the Holocaust, the Americans and British.
Right, but they knew that the concentration camps were operating.
But the church had unique information because they had thousands of parish priests in Poland and in Romania and in Croatia where these slaughters were taking place, reporting what was happening to the bishops, who sent it on in diplomatic pouches to the Vatican. But the Pope was frozen with indecision about publicly speaking out, because you're right, this is an organization that has survived the Huns, the ransacking of Rome. The earlier Pope was taken to France as a prisoner by Napoleon. Their view is stay out of the fight, duck down, keep a hand in each side, not knowing who will win. That's right.
They will survive. And the church will survive, and the gates of hell will not prevail.
That's right.
But what about rat lines? Tell us about rat lines.
Rat lines were the Vatican's efforts after World War II, or I should say at least Bishop Udall was an Austrian bishop inside of Rome, and a priest, Father Weber, to take money that was set aside for refugees and use it to ferry Nazi war criminals down to Argentina and Syria and other locations. In some instances, the priests who helped these Nazis were sympathetic to National Socialism. In some cases, they thought that these National Socialist Nazi war criminals would regroup and attack the communists at some point. And the general lack of Pius's speaking out against the Holocaust carried over into the rat lines in the post-war, because he never spoke out about the assistance being provided to these criminals. Then American and British intelligence decided to help their own set of Nazis, including Klaus Barbie and the intelligence people, and actually formed a partnership with the Vatican. So there's a point in which the American intelligence drops off Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Lyon, to a Father Dragonovich, who is a Eustachian priest inside of Rome, was running a rat line out of a seminary with Vatican oversight. And the Americans give him to Father Dragonovich, who then helps him get to Argentina, where a group of priests greet him in Buenos Aires when he arrives. It's an astonishing alliance.
Well, thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Joe Posner.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. Food and Dining, up next.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. We're throwing you off, Linda.
I'm too busy to eat barbecue to participate in this.
Yes, I don't know if that's called eating or I don't know what you were doing. We're joined now by chef, author, syndicated columnist, and friend, Cordon Bleu chef.
Thank you.
Linda Gassenheimer. Hi, Linda.
Consultant. Hello. Also.
Bonnie, you and Joe have smiles on your face. I'm kind of wondering.
Of course, wine columnist Fred Tasker is waiting in the wings, and we'll talk about a big Coconut Grove event this weekend. Now, it just happens to be one of Joe's favorite topics. Could it be pork? I mean, barbecue?
Both. All right, yeah.
Okay, and that's it, all right?
Okay.
Yes, all right, we're grilling. We knew that was Joe's favorite topic. But, Joe, have you ever turned out a burned black chicken from the grill or this one? You cut into a steak that's charred on the outside and it's
no,
raw inside?
No, but I've seen others
inside.
Do it, yes.
Yeah, right. Well, here to give us some grilling tips is Phil Bryant. He's the chef at the local craft food and drink restaurant. So welcome, Chef Phil Bryant.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And also, well, we're glad you came because you filled the studio. You've made Joe very, very happy. Wait till everyone hears what you've brought and we've been eating. My goodness, wow. Also with us is, who's with us? Tony Abell. We got so excited about the barbecue.
It's all right. I'll forgive you.
Oh, thanks. Tony Abello is the creator of this event, Grilling in the Grove. And he's also giving us some tips about your home grilling tips, right, Tony?
That's right, Linda.
Oh, okay, good. Right. Thank you, Tony. And we'd, of course, love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any grilling questions or maybe some tips for us? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. And we do have email.
We do. We have internet, too.
Okay.
It's radio@WLRN.org.
And we also have our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read his wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes columns, and you can also read his wine column that's now in the Saturday Herald. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking today?
Well, you can't possibly grill without having good wine, so I'm going to give you a few tips about wine with grilling.
Sounds good to me. Well, let's start with Phil Bryant. Phil, let's talk about our black and charred meats and our burned, dried-out chicken and all.
Oh, God.
give us some tips about this.
I think the main thing to remember when you're grilling is low and slow. A lot of people tend to start their fire, start their grill, and try to get the meat on right away before letting the coals get nice and even temperature. The thing to remember when you're grilling outdoors is you want to keep the temperature around 250, 300 degrees, and you want a nice, even coal bed or whatever type of fuel you're using. You want it nice, even, and low. So you're cooking the meat.
And unless it's steak, you probably want it indirect if you have charcoal.
Yeah, exactly.
So explain that, how that works.
Well, I mean, if you're cooking with a steak, you know, you want to get that char on there. But you also, like what Linda said, you don't want to char the outside and have a raw inside and what we call like a Pittsburgh steak. So
you want to ask about that. Okay.
Here come the email from the Pittsburgh people.
Yeah. Oh, it's not a bad thing. Don't get me wrong. But you want to cook it off from the heat source. So you're actually bringing the internal temperature of the meat
up. But how do you sear it? Do you have to sear it first or just let it cook?
Just slowly. Let it cook. That's the other thing to remember about barbecuing is just let the thing cook. You know, don't flip it around too much. Don't play with it too much. You know, don't play with your food is basically the lesson.
And how do you know it's cooked through? Don't, you know, you press your thumb on the thing and all of that. That's really difficult to find out.
Well, when it comes to something like a steak or a chop or something, what you can do is you can get an instant-read thermometer or, you know, a thermometer from any barbecue store, any hardware store. Temp the meat. Usually rare, you want about 120. Mid-rare, you want about 130. Medium, you want about 130, 135. I don't suggest going any higher than that, but if you want something well done, you're talking about the 140s, 150s. And then when you're talking about barbecue, you're talking about more of a texture kind of thing, more of a feel. When you're cooking ribs or brisket or something like that, you want the meat, the protein, to basically just yield to gentle pressure. And that's through a long, slow cooking process.
Well, that's great advice. That's tricky. Tony Abello, you told me you had your own little special home cooking tips.
Well, one of my pet peeves is people that use charcoal versus grills, like one of those great debates. But of course, gases. I'm sorry, charcoal versus gas is a great debate. And I like using charcoal. It's more natural. It has that flavor. But my pet peeve is the instant light charcoal. They embed that with some chemical that makes it instant light. So I tell everybody, please don't do that. Buy one of those chimneys. They work phenomenal.
So tell us, how do you get it started?
So basically,
and how far in advance do we have to think about getting it started?
No, it would take more or less the same time, maybe 5 minutes more. So those chimneys, they kind of look like big coffee cans with holes at the bottom and a handle. So you put some tinder in the bottom, newspaper, something like that, charcoal on top, and you light it by the bottom. And then since it has holes, it brings in a lot of air and oxygen and allows it to burn really, really nice. And then once the coals start getting white at the top of the chimney, then you put in your barbecue, you spread them around.
With gloves.
Yeah, or with tongs or something.
Sounds like you've had that problem before, Joe.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just, as Phil said, you know, nice, even heat, and that's really key. No lighter fluid. That taste does come through in your meat.
Linda, do you barbecue?
She's too high. Linda's too high rent.
That was too long a pause.
That was a long pause.
I paused on purpose. Well, I let other people in my family do the barbecue.
Okay. All right, just wondering.
Do you, Bonnie?
No, I've never done it.
You've never done it?
No,
I have done. I do it, but I'm always sort of in the kitchen getting everything else ready.
Right.
And send my husband out for the barbecue. But also, you know, that speaks to the point that you need to have your sides. And what are your favorite sides to go with the barbecue?
Well, I'm a big, I'm from the South, so I'm a big Southern sides kind of guy. So my favorites are like, you know, the collard greens that are stewed slow with the ham hocks, you know, barbecue baked beans. I like a lot of grilled vegetable sides, especially if I'm cooking outdoors. So, you know, when corn's in season, some nice grilled corn with a little bit of butter and salt. You know.
So how do you grill your corn on the grill?
The way I like to do it.
I'm going to talk about it later, so go ahead.
Yeah, the way I like to do it is I like to grill it actually in the husk. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily get as much of that char in there, but what happens is the corn actually steams in the husk, and a lot of those natural sugars come out. So you end up with a really sweet, really moist kind of corn kernel, kind of like when you get grilled corn at the fair.
Do you soak it?
What's that?
You soak it in water?
You soak it in a little bit of water so the outsides don't burn. And then, like I said, if you ever go to a fair and get corn on the cob, they simply just peel back the husk, dip it in some butter, a little salt on top, and it's some of the best stuff you'll ever eat.
Wow. Well, you're going to be cooking, doing a cooking demonstration at the Grilling in the Grove, which is Sunday,
yep.
March 8th. So you brought us what you're going to be making there, and that's what we were all ooing and aahing about at the beginning. So tell us what you brought.
So we're going to be doing country-style pork ribs with a molasses barbecue sauce. It's a very simple recipe to make. That's why we wanted to do it for the demo. I think a lot of people get intimidated by barbecue. Some things you talk about, like briskets, that can take 16, 18, 24 hours. Some people don't have time to do things like that. So
I would say that would be difficult.
Yeah. So we got these country-style pork ribs, and the great thing about them is they come from the end of the pork loin. So they have a good amount of lean meat. So it's like you're eating a nice thin pork chop.
So this is a cut of meat. When I go into the store, what I ask for, because these pork ribs are really thick and juicy and a lot of meat on them.
Yeah.
And it comes from the
pork It comes from loin. The end of the loin. So as the loin tapers off and the bones stop, that's where they get these ribs from. And so you get a little bit of that lean meat that you get from the pork loin, but you also get a little bit of fatty meat that comes from the end of the rib. As well, so it's kind of a good versatile.
So you
cut.
Ask for country style pork.
Country rib. Style pork ribs. Yep.
And it doesn't take long to cook. Then you told me.
No,
because it's not. You don't have to do hours and hours.
No, it takes a little bit of preparation ahead of time. What we did with these was we brined them overnight in a little bit of sweet tea, brown sugar, some honey. So that makes the meat a little bit more tender, a little bit more juicy. And then we simply kiss it on the grill for about 15-20 minutes till they're cooked through. And paint them with a little bit of our molasses barbecue sauce, and that's it.
So, well, if you want to know how to do that, how to make it, you're going to be showing everyone. At the Grilling in the Grove. Tony Abello, how did you get involved with starting this grilling event in the Grove?
Well, in Miami, it's always summer, right? But for me, the summer, the outdoor, the park season starts now in March. It's spring break happens, and we have great weather year-round. And I'm a big barbecuer at home. And I said, you know, there's a chili cook-off up north, and there's Rib Fest down in Homestead, but down in the center of Miami where I live in South Miami, in Coconut Grove, there's nothing really like that. I said, man, it would be great if we could bring together some great barbecue in the park on a Sunday, family friendly. We started working on it, and Grilling in the Grove was born.
Okay. That's
how many years old is it?
This is the first year.
Oh.
Yeah. So it's an inaugural year. We're really excited about it. We have a lot of tickets. A lot of people are going. We have a lot of great chef demos, a lot of great participating restaurants. There's a VIP area. There's activities for kids. Kids under 12 are free.
And it's this Sunday?
It's this Sunday.
And
this
what time? Sunday.
It starts at 11 and ends at sundown, which is at 7, maybe a little bit early. From Saturday to Sunday is daylight savings hour. So we're going to lose a little bit of time.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
So about 6-ish, 7-ish.
Okay, and if they want tickets, how do they get them?
They can go to grillinginthegrove.com. Just do a Google search and it'll pop up. It's super simple. It's right in the middle of the grove. You can't miss it. And a lot of beer, a lot of barbecue, and all types of barbecue, not just American style. You know, one of the things we forget is that there's Argentine style, there's Brazilian Rodizio. There's a lot of different, you know, cooking over coals from other countries that we're going to have.
Oh, very exciting. Well, we're talking with the local craft food and drink restaurant chef, Phil Bryant, and Grilling in the Grove creators. You just heard all about the creations, Tony Albello. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking about grilling and barbecue with the local craft food and drink restaurant chef, Phil Bryant, and Tony Albello. He's the creator of Grilling in the Grove, the event that's going to happen this Sunday, March 8th. And they've been giving us some great grilling tips, and we've been eating some good food, too. But if you're looking for more great food and a good cause, the Fort Lauderdale Museum of Discovery and Science is holding their wine, spirits, and culinary celebration, and it's called D3, as in Drink, Dine, Drink, Discover, and that's March 13th. And there's going to be tastings from over 40 South Florida restaurants. If you want more information, you can go to MODS. That's like the name of the museum, modsevents.org, or just contact the museum. Well, one more event.
Sorry.
Joe's eating every single barbecue piece in the place. And he's not leaving any for
his,
you, Bonnie.
His mother had an expression. It was, put your foot on it and growl. That's what he's doing.
Okay.
He is destroying.
Don't growl. All right?
Oh, it's so good.
Well, let's talk about another event. And that event's called Feeding the Planet, Energy for Life. And that's going to be next Thursday, March 12th. And it's at the Miami-Dade College Wilson campus. It's a full-day event. And by the way, I'm going to be moderating a panel that morning, and it's called Understanding the Relationship Between Food and Health. So come and say hello to me. If you want more information, go to Feeding the Planet Miami. All right, so now we have dinner in minutes. So if we've made you really, really hungry for a barbecue and you want to make some at home, this is a quick and easy barbecue dinner. And by the way, if you don't have access to a barbecue, you can make it on a stovetop grill. It's Mike Golick's Barbecue Blitz Chicken Wraps. Now, if you don't know who Mike Golick is, I had to be instructed. You know who he is,
Went
Joe.
To Notre Dame, played in the NFL. Does Mike and Mike show on ESPN now?
Yes, that's it. Well, I was surprised that this famous football player loves to cook at home for his family. And he says he cooks simple food and he just throws everything on the grill. So to make these wraps, you season some boneless, skinless chicken thighs with salt and pepper, and you grill them about 5 minutes, and then you turn them a few more minutes, and they're done, 165 degrees, or 170 degrees for thighs. And at the same time, you put some onion slices on the grill, and you cook those about the same time it takes to cook the chicken. And just before they're finished, here's the tip I give you, is you put the barbecue sauce on just before it's finished, because otherwise it'll burn. And chefs, they're both Tony and Chef Phil are saying, yes, yes, that's okay. That's good advice. So you remove the chicken and from the grill, and you shred the chicken. While they're on the grill, you wrap some tortillas in foil and put that on the grill just for a few minutes to warm through. Fill the tortillas with the chicken, the onion, the diced tomatoes, and some lettuce, and you wrap it up. It's very easy. Now, we talked earlier about corn on the grill. So I have another corn on the grill recipe from Mike Golick, and that is you wrap the corn. You take the husk off, you wrap it in the foil with some butter and some Parmesan cheese, and then you grill it for 10 minutes and turn it and grill it for another 5 minutes, and that's your grilled corn. So you can find the complete recipe and a photo. It's at dinnerinminutes.com. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking?
What are we listening to?
What do you got?
It's Paul's... I don't know how to stop it. It's Paul's streaming all this. So I wanted to see what it was, and I didn't realize the sound was going to come on. Sorry.
Now, where were we, Linda?
Hello. Paul Leary is our engineer, and Bonnie is not a good engineer. All right. Fred Tasker, take us out of this and tell us what we're going to... We need a drink now.
Well, you know, I'm having a little trouble with our connection here, too, so I hope this works.
We're hearing you.
Anyway, you probably think that just because it's 5 below and blowing snow where I live, we Northerners don't do grilling in the winter.
But you're in Michigan,
you think that,
in case
you're
people
probably
don't
wrong.
Know. Yes.
We have grilling ways that will work no matter what the weather. But first, let me talk about hot weather grilling, because it's getting to be hot weather in WLRN country. I see today it's already going to be 83, which is way too hot. Anyway, when I lived in Miami, I grilled all through the steamy, soggy summer. I pulled the grill up to the back door, turned the air conditioning as low as it would go, aimed a floor fan at the back of my neck, and poured myself a glass of cheap champagne over ice, which is usually a sin, but not in this situation. Well, in northern Michigan, we tough guys do just the opposite. We pull the grill out just past the door of the garage. We put a floor fan behind us to bring some warm air from the house and blow out the smoke. And we grill away right through the blizzards. And if you go online, you can see that Weber, the grill people, has even put out a very practical list of tips for cold weather grilling. And the first tip is take a little nip of something before you start to dull the pain. Although, actually, that's my tip, not Weber's. You carefully shovel a path to the grill so you don't slip while carrying those gorgeous ribeyes. And here's the really practical one. They say tuck your scarf into your coat collar so it doesn't dangle over the grill and catch fire. Now, that I would never have thought of that. You should use a timer to control doneness, because opening the grill even for a few seconds can lose you 40 degrees. And if you want to chill some wine for dinner, if it's white wine, you plop it in the snowbank. See how practical.
I'm so glad
are.
You're giving us all this information when it's 83 degrees here, Fred.
Yeah, I know. You guys are all jealous, I'm sure. It's about 4 degrees right now
here.
Yes. But, okay, well, let's talk about the wine that you do, because that's the same in the south or the north. The red wine, you could do this with two wines. The red wine would be Zinfandel, which is rich, hearty, generous, a great wine for meat with black crisscross scars all over it. And the white wine would be Sauvignon Blanc, which is herbal and even grassy, and an excellent match for fish, chicken, and especially for veggies, containing those same charcoal-grilled injuries. These two wines are equally good choices if you're grilling in the South Florida cold snap, when you have to work up the courage to go out into that body-numbing 50-degree air.
Thank you.
But the one final tip, be sure you slip the flask back in your coat pocket before you go back inside to your house and your friends and your wife.
All right. Thank you for that advice. We'll be all set for grilling in the snow, Fred Tasker. All right. We just have about a minute left here. Phil Bryant at the local, do you serve wine, beer? What do you serve with your barbecue?
Well, I mean, we're kind of known for our craft beer selection. We have 18 rotating taps of craft beer. We have a small kind of intimate wine list, but mainly what we try to serve is a different daily selection of beer to go with our food.
Well, sounds good to me.
With that, I wanted to suggest, if you ever have any barbecue, sometimes, you know, spicy, IPAs, Imperial Pale Ales, are a little bit stronger, hoppier, and those are great for taming any kind of spicy food, spicy barbecue. Imperial IPA or IPAs, Imperial Pale Ale.
I couldn't agree more. That's a nice combination.
Yeah. So I mean I love barbecue. I like things a little bit spicy. So I put a little bit of spice in there and an IPA, nice and cold. I can't think of anything better except maybe grilling in the snow
with a flask.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, go ahead, Bonnie. Tony. I just wanted to say the event is Sunday, but would you give everybody that tip that you gave us before?
About the parking?
Yeah.
Okay. So the event is Sunday. It's in right in the middle of Peacock, in Coconut Grove at Peacock Park. But a lot of times people say, wow, parking is so tough in the Grove. There's three great parking garages, but one is like a little hidden gem. It's underneath the Sonesta, and it's you're going to think you're parking in the Sonesta, but you're not. It is a public parking garage, has a very small sign that doesn't look like it, but it's right there, right across from the park.
Okay.
Super easy to get to.
Right. Okay. All right. So look for public parking in the Grove. It's been another very tasty week, and Joe Cooper's eaten all of the pork.
Indeed.
Here.
Indeed.
Yes.
Enjoyed it.
Bonnie, you and I kind of, you know,
left well, out. Watched.
Right, we watched. Chef Phil Bryant from the local Kraft Food and Drink, thank you so much for joining us and for the delicious food.
Thank you for having
thank
me.
Thank you.
Good luck at the Grove this Sunday.
All right, we'll
with your
see you
demonstration.
There.
Right, we sure will. His restaurant is located at 150 Giralda Avenue in Coral Gables. Tony Abello, thank you for joining us, and good luck on grilling in the Grove.
Thank you. I actually thought I had a shot at that last rib, Joe.
I was wrong. Come by the restaurant.
Okay. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
And stay warm. Bonnie and Joe, you ate well today. Next week, we'll be celebrating St. Patrick's Day with Martin Lynch from John Martin's Restaurant Irish Pub in Coral Gables. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
Thanks, Linda.
And that wraps it up this hour. Our producer, Richard Ive, technical direction by online producer, Paul Leary. Tomorrow at 1, it's the South Florida Arts Beat with producer and host Ed Bell, another live studio concert.
It's the excellent Latin funk band Electric Piquete.
We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Bonnie and I return Monday with a program about most everyone's foe, anxiety. In some form, it affects 40 million Americans. Hear about My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. And today's calendar, on this day in 1770, 245 years ago, the Boston Massacre erupts. Five Americans die after baiting British soldiers. The Redcoats were tried and acquitted, defended by John Adams. And on this day in 1963, 52 years ago, the death of country music's greatest female singer, 31-year-old Patsy Cline. An airplane crash in Tennessee. Willie Nelson wrote her greatest hit, Crazy. One more while we're not ready for prime time. On this day in 1982, 33 years ago, the death of comedian John Belushi of a drug overdose in West Hollywood, California. Belushi was of Albanian descent. So we leave with a thought from Patsy Cline, whose dream house had gold dust sprinkled into the bathroom tile. Quote, I got a 12-year-old girl who plays steel guitar out of this world. She also plays a sax and she sings. Looks like a blonde doll. Her name is Barbara Mandrell. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gassenheimer, Fred Tasker, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now next from NPR News.